if you...
So I don't know what the situation is for you.
Well, kind of hard to work with, where your money losing value every day. Good luck.
In the submission of Master 91 under section 9, you indicate indicated that the bill should make provision for a dispute resolution. But even in his submission, he also refers to the promotion of administration of justice act. Now, my question to Mr. Naidu is that is there a problem in following that particular route? Or do you think if we build in a dispute resolution clause into this bill, will be speed up the process? If you can just elaborate on that, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I wanted to stop here and get responses, but I suspect it's going to be the last.
Thank you, sir.
If you have any other smile.
Honorable member from West has taken my point, but it's on page 9. It's on page 9, the last bullet in the 9th of section 2, section 2, and also condition of exit from section in part of page 10 on the condition of priority from section 11. If Mr. Naidu can clarify and elaborate a bit on his process.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Professor Manoj, I apologize for that. I did codify the graph of the Duke University because I did that particular slide without clear tutorial. The other one I added last night. I apologize. Your point is well taken. Your second point. The second point is actually not an IP issue. It's much more a code of conduct issue. Whether or not you have an IP regime, honorable collaborators and dishonorable collaborators will operate in this world. And if people want to steal your work, before you can publish it or before you can register a patent, then that's what will happen. Hopefully we'll create a kind of environment where we're not competing for scraps, but we actually could have a very significant IP portfolio in the country. And we have a very large number of research papers that go to the international technical journals that we don't have to do. Then the issue around the EEEE, it's a very minor point. It's just that legally there isn't such a thing as a EEEE entity. And legally they're EEEE compliant entities. So if it continues in this form, it converts 11B to a clause that's not sufficiently qualified. But the other points you raised around the example, I think we can talk about that. And then putting this something together and continue to because I think that's a very important aspect. The issue on section 9 is that in the way it's written, it's almost as if you have any dispute between the NIPMO and the recipient, the only thing you can do is to go to court. And in our view, we would like the scenario where we very rarely go to court at all. And for that to happen, then we need to have a series of mechanisms that we can use for dispute resolution before we have to resort. That is essentially the point that we make. And I think it will be both in the interest of the institutions, both NIPMO and the recipient, as well as the other partners that they would have for that to happen. Otherwise, all we're doing is generating a reason for more human capital development and law fraternity, because they'll be the only people that know that. The issues associated with Section 11 the first big issue is the issue around exclusive and non-exclusive licensing. And the basic position we're taking is that you must specifically provide for exclusive licensing and in fact encourage it. And in response to Honorable Ainsley, maybe the use of the word feasible in the clause may resolve that. The issue associated with 11E, which talks about the state having an irrevocable and royalty-free license authorizing the state to use and have intellectual property use throughout the world for health, security, and emergency needs of the public. What we're pointing out is that the first issue is to ensure that that clause is, in fact, allowing us to comply with the international agreements that we've made. Secondly, that each of those around health needs, security needs, and emergency needs, both need to be clearly defined in their own right, and to have a mechanism to declare it, following which we can use this kind of approach. And the further thing that I pointed out with that is that unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, for this particular clause, we currently don't have a precedent in the world, and no one actually agrees yet. Well, as far as I could scan the literature, maybe the other folks know that. So I think not a blush there, I was worried that we're not saying anything, but after I've closed my lips, I'm testing my patience.
Mr. Chairman, no, I want to say this. Can we, at the further meeting when we discuss this clause on clause 9, have a copy of that Act 2000, Act Number 3, and then we will understand better what should be taken out. And I want to congratulate Mr. Naidu for taking the bull out of the bull, coming from the blue bull part of the country.
Okay. Mr. Naidu, I must, before you run away, I must thank you very much for your insightful presentation. But there are issues that need to be taken forward. So for instance, you raised a very fundamental issue of principle, where we've got to separate issues from the law into regulation. That type of matter. But I get worried when you just, on the other hand, try to say, let's leave this out of the law and put it into the regulation and leave a vacuum into law in terms of what this is. I was looking at the three clauses. Regulations are there to support the implementation of law and not the other way around. I think it's a matter that we must engage further, but I've taken your point on this one. And then the issue that you raised about, that was raised about, the public interest versus the private exclusivity. I think the matter that needs further engagement because it doesn't follow. I mean, precedent in this country that it's not all the time that private venture have to take a risk that the government or public sector is taking many. So we've got to balance those type of dynamics as we go on. And we would want to follow up on that Brazil example that you gave. To be able to deal with the question that is raised by Ms. Rao, which you made an example, but I think it's important that we follow up on this. I take your point about technology transfer. Maybe as we go on with the presentations and so on and definition, somebody will assist us to do the typical question that you have raised and not provided an answer for the chair of your office. The literature that you're going to share with us, we will look forward to that clarification. Okay, but just before you run away, the point about foreign law in terms of the definition of intellectual property, I think it's something that the department must take note of as well because it's quite broad and small so that we can find a way of dealing with such law. You know, we in many instances try to be very clear and specific in terms of what we say into law and making it as simple as possible. You're presenting a challenge to us to say, listen, clauses 5 and 6 can incorporate 7 and delete 7. You see, we would like to see your views on that. We still want to engage you with you on that in terms of what is the rationale. And you don't complicate things further by doing that because I was thinking that we simplify it. But if that's your firm view, I think you must continue to defend that view so that when we take a decision on this matter, we should be able to do that. Does promotion of justice mean that it's just taking it to court? Or are you suggesting that, you know, before we implement this law, we must have something here, like Mr. Blanche said, that dispute resolution mechanism, what is specifically in law, and that doesn't exclude that if you include the provision of, I think it's 9-6. That's something that we still have to engage. I'm just highlighting this matter for us to be able to. I want to deal with the issues of the emergencies and the issues that we raised in 11 because I think they are sufficient to their focus. So, thank you very much. Thank you.
No, I would say maybe my parents, why ran away from DTI? Why you ran away from DTI?
You have been exposed now. I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry about that. You can see that he was a poor take just a life. That is the time that he must be for that question. So thank you very much. I think Ash is ready. The second presenter should be ready. Are they ready now? Because all of us who go to jump and we'll take the next one. I was informed, as a head of the church council, I was informed that you're waiting for this presentation is here now. If you're ready, come to the floor. If you're not, I'm taking the next presenter. You look ready. You know, if this was an AOC meeting, I'm going to sing a revolutionary song while we are coming here. But unfortunately, you're not. Mr. Blanche will take very much exception to singing Baya Kala. Okay. Are you ready, man? Are you going to use this? Alright, okay. Stand up and then stand up and then. Members, after the Agricultural Research Council, we are going to take the next presenter, which is Bowen Incorporated, on behalf of Kenyo Sato Sapi. And you can see that. If he has to give us a good time. Everybody, all members have got this. All right. Black and white. Black and white. Color. Black and white and color. Madam, let's let the gentleman set up so you can start talking. Just introduce yourself and so on and so on. So that at least we've got some people who can. Some good information.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mary Singh. Masalahum from the Cultural Research Council. I'm with my colleague here, Ms. Rabuli, Yubu Rabuli. We must have apologize for Mr. Rabuli who is here. He has other committees to attend to. So far, our presentation is we have prepared a presentation for the committee on our comments on the item. We're only going to be focusing on a couple of sections and not on the entire bill. Our presentation is going to address to remind the committee of our mandate, which is to conduct research, technology development, technology transfer to promote agriculture and industry, to contribute to the security of the earth, and to ensure national resource preservation. We will now move into our input, the bill. Inputs are going to be addressed on Section 9, Section 10, Section 12, and Section 18. We have zoomed into Section 4, 9, 4E, and found that the way to provide is authoritative in this regard. Hence, we then propose that the word develop is a substitute provide. In this regard, we saw that it will ensure that the recipient is part of the decision making. And that, again, that this will be a relaxation on the guidelines that are to be developed. In this way, it will provide the recipient with the opportunity to maneuver within business constraints. This will be only on a case-to-case basis, but then will then subsequently inform you more of education from the guidelines provided. Again, then we're focusing on Section 10.1. And Section 10.1, what we show about it is that ripples discourage qualified researchers from foreign countries in participating in the advancement of any South African research. We feel in this regard that at ARC we employ a whole range of qualified expert researchers, and that these employees will eventually leave the country. They will not ordinarily reside in South Africa after retirement or even before that. So this we feel that it will hamper opportunities if they get disadvantaged in the benefit sharing, because we also rely on them to perpetuate the good name of the ARC with their associated institutions and the institutions that they intend to get employed in. This also helps the ARC in competing in the international market. And then again, I will move to Section 10.2, which speaks of the 20% revenue generation. We saw that the stipulation under 20% should be removed. This should be left up to the discretion of the recipient. And we feel like it rely on a good benefit scheme to attract and retain good experts and researchers. Hence, we are developing attractive internal investment. Alternatively, if the 20% is not removed from the bill, we suggest that the 20% be of the net revenue and not of the board. And then we have moved to Section 12.1. In this regard, we saw that the provisions of the discussion, they are restrictive and they are cumbersome. This will have a negative impact on trade to having to go every time to new more to report this and report that and get approval for this and get approval for that. We suggest that the section should allow for flexibility and then the decision be afforded the leverage to conduct business transactions, to conclude business transactions, and then only inform you for the purposes and not for approval. And we then move into Section 8. We must again say that the AFP is happy about the funding for the system and but then hence we suggest that it should be made clear if whether these are going to also the funding is also going to be provided for legal enforcement on IP rights. And now, in our conclusion, ARC must say that it's in support of the bill, and hence it has already started with, it has initiated certain processes. We just recently had our intellectual property policy approved by council. Now it's just need to start implementing, and that this IP policy is in line with the NFS, and that we've already established an office of technology transfer in which it's going to be in operation. And thank you very much. That goes to the ARC people.
Short and sweet. Thank you very much. You want more? very much. Remember, there is the input from the Special Research Council for engagement.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, no, I've just looked at the bill here today. It's quite clear that the department consulted quite a number of stakeholders, including the Department of Agriculture. Now, my question is that when this engagement took place, was the Research Council also involved in that particular process? The reason why I'm asking this is that I know this is our democracy was taken have a second by the Chair of Parliament. But if the Department of Science and Technology can just explain to us, I'm sure they made these presentations at that level as well. And what were the differences and why was it possible?
Thank you very much. The Department does not know that. When you respond, you come back to us on those questions. So. But you have to say something about that. You know, you have to comment. You may. Go ahead.
If I may, I'll leave it up to the department to take that out.
No comment on it. Anybody else? Marcia?
If ARC asking us not to allow foreign researchers to come to South Africa, are we asked to eliminate competition?
No. Our comment is exception, discourage foreign employees and foreign collaboration. Hence, we bring the comment that the section should be removed. Yes. Or we were there in a moment.
Just that, I think you must just refer to the section, I think, 10. This must 10 itself, section 1, where the beneficiaries and their hands are scratched. And they go on, but specifically exclude non-South Africans. That's what they are like. Not to say we should exclude them. But the point is taken. But that's why we see we must also check how far we go. We sold out so much of our rights to foreign beneficiaries that we can't do anything else about. Then here, and they do it somewhere else. And get it back, very expensive. So we want what a bit of criticism also to be honest. You're on our side as well. Huh? Okay. Nothing against foreigners, please. Alright.
Yeah, no, just one small thing also. There is no one on the change of effects. This international property creator. That the deal says that it's a lower limit that the deal is actually taking. And you are saying it must be removed. You want institutions to give them 10%, 5%? How do we, as government, for instance, see that there is no expectation of this deal? What is it that we are encouraging? The RAM says, give, by all means, if institutions like it, you can give them 50%. You can give them 60%, but you are saying the lower limit that it is. Why are you doing that? What is it that your institution is afraid of? Is it because you give them less? Well, the only rationale is you have to give them less. What is the value of the rationale for each other? That's the reason. And the implication there, for example, for them, you think that it's alternative to 20% of their net. Because I would have thought that, that's what it says here, it was a revenue generator. Because the input and everything, take them out and kill them. But not generated the input. You see, that's for me, I think it is implied, unless I can be proven wrong. Sometimes we need to.
I'll start by the 20% next. There was an interaction with the institution, as in just this is this clearly reflected on the bill itself, whether it is net or gross? Some people believe that it meant net, some people believe that it meant gross. So hence then we feel that it would be better off if it is stated in clear terms as in whether it is net or gross. And then under the removal of the minimum, I leave that to my colleague to comment on that.
Okay.
The idea is not to have it entirely, is to allow people to return to the system. And to deal with issues relating to incentivizing their own employees. With the same blame, it's not the system to say, this is what we have to go to. But the same thing as the minimum, but it is allowing the system to get a well ordered system and be able to become a normal person.
Okay, I suspect there will be a method between yourselves. We're not worried about that. We just worried about, you know, let's put a benchmark. Let's say, you know, this is 20%, at least 20%. And it's not, there's no full stop after that, or such amount. The minister also, you can make a presentation to the minister and say, listen, this is something else that you're looking for. So it's not close, okay? But we take your point, but on this one, I think that we're starting with. I'm going to try and close this one. I'm not sure you'll be there. Anyone else? I'm closing the Abana. The Abana. Section 12.1. I will ask that one out. Only notifying limbo of all offshore intellectual property transactions for medical purposes are not for approved. Shouldn't Limbo be in a position to be able to pay to researchers who are duplicating work done at another institution and therefore work from public? Okay. Okay.
The reason why we stated it is because the system states that the intellectual transactions that you do the end in having been to be able to get a full bus. So imagine if the AMP will enter into the laws of international transaction that every time you have to go to Nimbo to get approval for this transaction. Some of the people that the international collaborators might be discouraged to say there's a lot of things that you have to approve from all the people. So we're saying maybe we should allow flexibility to enter into this transaction and then report.
What if those transactions are really there nationally? What if you sold out everything? And just go to the and say, look at this book, that I'm sorry, what is called?
The ARC is this type of government system, the data we have found, and because we have our own exchange, we have to in the country for the benefit of the nation. So I don't think we can in any instance enter into transaction that would be detrimental to government people.
Okay. So, we've taken your point. I'll come back to you.
Yeah, well, we've got Mr.
Alan to ask his point of view on this, because I think he's got international experience in the school, which might be useful to us while we still have him in the center.
Okay, let's allow that. On this particular one about yes, sir.
I was just taking a drink, so I'm, could you ask me the question again? Because my jet lag is starting to kick in. So if you just phrase what you'd like me to comment on, I'd be happy to help you if I can.
The provision of Section 12.1, we are asked to remove it because it's cumbersome. Have you got any views on it from international experience?
No. Let's do that. Let's note it,
yes.
So that both yourself and Mr. Allen, they can come back to us with a much more comprehensive report.
I'd be happy to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Blasher, you caught me off guard. No, Rale Bohama. Rale Bohama, we see all the points that you're raising and about non-South Africans getting discouraged and so on. And the 50% issue that you're raising, and the question of the recipient, I mean, for the level that you're raising. Now, don't you think that the issue of the legal cost, if you're asking us whether you're going to pay the legal cost, you know, some of your legal bills are very high now. So, maybe we should have the regulations really specify more in terms of how far we go. In terms of, because NIPMO will come up. But just to explain so that NIPMO will determine in terms of what to pay and what to pay for. But if they are spelled out much more in regulation, I think it would be much more. Okay. So can we leave it at that? Rale Bohama. Thank you very much. The next presenter, is that it? Yeah, I think you are next.
Mr. Chairman, we are free. Do you want us to say, hey, we don't need your facility, we can do it from here, are you comfortable with that?
Oh, you don't need it. Let me put the facility go on, please.
Thank you, sir.
Except that they want to, but it's okay. It's a light green team there. There will be disadvantage, but they will hear your voice. Okay? Members, the presentation is the one that is going to take to you. So, the one that you've gone through already has been respect. So, just go ahead and introduce the team, please. And, those who did not receive this advance is in the second pack, that is the presentation 11. The second supplementary package.
Mr. Chair, this is a joint submission, not only by myself or by the Wolf and Bauer, but in fact on behalf of the three parties who are jointly submitting the submission, and that is the Anglos, Sappen and Sappel. I myself am talking on behalf of the Anglos. Baradas are talking on behalf of Saffron. She's also an employee in the place of the attorney of Saffron. And Mr. Ulane is the senior legal advisor of Saffron, talking on behalf of Saffron. We will try our best to stay within the time frame, and we will not address the same issues. So if I may propose that questions are dealt with afterwards, as we're dealing with different points, so as to form a comprehensive submission. That is just a suggestion, sir.
Right.
there is more than just the obvious reason in making a joint submission. Not only do the Anglos, Sappi and Sappho present the material, if not the majority part of private money for research and development at institutions, but we most definitely agree on our approach. So what we are saying here today is because we are in agreement and feel the same in how we approach it. It's not just a practical joining of the submission. We unequivocally support the bill and the intentions of the legislature. There can be no doubt that we believe it's necessary to clarify and codify the position in at publicly funded institutions. The bill is, however, about publicly financed research and development. And this takes place at many institutions, including at universities. We all know three types of financing. It is the obvious, the publicly financed research. It is privately financed research, where a private sector funds all of the research being done in that particular project. And there's the co-finance. And we are being told that the majority of all research and development, and particularly in the universities, constitute or is constituted by co-finance research. So from our perspective, it's paramount that the bill deals and clearly provides for co-finance research. The crux of co-finance research is the private public relationship. And if that relationship is not fostered and protected, I would think that whatever one hopes to get from co-finance research is at risk. The primary aspect underlying that relationship is obviously the managing of public funds, the securing of benefits for South Africa in general, but also very specifically for the health, wealth, and learning of South Africans. And South Africans, in the broad sense, my intention is not to exclude foreign visitors. The protection of that very relationship, and that such research and development and the commercialization of it is done in a sustainable, stroke commercially viable manner. If we all appreciate those issues, I would like to visit the submission itself. The submission deals primarily with three issues: legal stroke drafting issues relating to clarity, ambiguity, equity, etc. And I do not intend dealing with those specifically in this oral submission, but we are happy to consider any question or issue we believe that that has been spelled out. And it's not quite the intention of this oral submission. The second issue is, or aspect of the submission, is administrative issues. For example, it's all fine in the world to empower DIPMO with many responsibilities and load them with many responsibilities and rights and obligations, but at the end, national capacity dictates. Now, yes, lawyers are a dime a dozen. You all have heard the white mouse example. Why do they use lawyers for research? Because nobody falls in love with it. But in principle, the capacity in South Africa for the commercialization of innovation is perhaps much more or much less than the capability of doing research and development itself. What I'm trying to say is that do not forget that the success of this bill, at least in our mind, directly relates to the capacity in South Africa to deal with innovation commercialization. The third issue is the one that I would like to deal with, and that is about ownership and use of the research outcomes, the research and development outcomes, the so-called intellectual property or IP. From a general perspective, ownership and use is dealt with in section 4, which is paragraph 6 of our submission. We submit that there's a conflict between the bill and intellectual property legislation as it stands nearly internationally. It is not an insurmountable conflict, but it is a real conflict and a threatening one. The IPR bill is based on public finance. So if a product contains or is based on a degree or a portion of public finance, the intellectual property vest in the university. And the bill is very clear. If you look at section 4 of the bill, section 4.1, it says, subject to section 15.2, intellectual property arising from public finance, research and development shall be owned by the recipient. Now, intellectual property law nearly internationally is based on creatorship and the rights flowing from there, i.e. the Chinese of the rights of the creators versus the bill, which is built on public finance, which makes the intellectual property from such projects vested in the institutions. You will remember that the earlier draft of the bill endeavored to link it with employment, the employees of the institutions, and there was a rather broad definition of for employees. For reasons not necessarily discussed yet, they had their own difficulty, and we have now moved to publicly or public finance as basis. This could lead to conflict. This would lead to conflict if there's a conflict in the ownership. Because at the end of the day, unless I'm mistaken, intellectual property laws will dictate that the improvements, the research outcomes vest in the creators, regardless of what this bill says. And if this bill dictates that it vests in the institutions, at least my personal opinion, is that the institutions would then have a personal claim against those who claim ownership from the material substantive law, such as patent law, etc. I'm not suggesting for a moment that it's wrong in the bill. I'm saying it is in conflict with legislation as it stands, material legislation for patent ownership and use of intellectual property. If one looks at the specific provision with regard to ownership, one has to look at section 15, paragraph 11 of the submission. Section 15 provides for exclusive licensing in 15.1. Co-owned intellectual property or co-ownership in terms of 15.2 and a bit of 15.3, and privately owned intellectual property in 15.4. Co-presenter Elaine will deal with forecast in much more clarity than I can hope to, so I'm going to leave that for him. What I would like to deal with is co-owned and co-ownership of intellectual property. And for that, one looks at 15.2, and you will see that in 15.2.4, it provides inter alia for a commercial agreement. Now, that gives most people great comfort to know that there will be an agreement that gives clarity, because the only way in which we're going to deal with a potential conflict that this bill may bring or might bring or could bring with the existing IP legislation is that there's a commercial agreement between the parties. The problem at the moment is that if you read the bill up to section 15, it talks about privately financed intellectual property. So it is as if it falls into that rather small portion, or not this portion at least that we are discussing at the moment, which is publicly financed intellectual property, public intellectual property, shortly. So if one looks at that, you will note that you have to go back on the rest of the bill from 15.2 and say, now, to what extent does the rest of the bill relate to co-ownership? One would, as the first stab at it, say, well, it relates to the institution's part of the share. But it's a bit like a glass of water. I own part of it and you own part of it. Now, who owns what part? Because they are largely inseparable. Because they are therefore indivisible or inseparable, it is important that we know how we can deal with this intellectual property or intellectual property portfolio as a whole through our coalition. It is therefore paramount that the bill clarifies in the case of co-ownership, how it impacts on that intellectual property. I not for a moment say that the private co-owner has a problem with the responsibilities that we highlighted earlier. You will remember that I identified the four aspects that are cardinal to the relationship the management of public finance, the securing of benefits for South Africa, the protection of the relationship and commercially viable, perhaps a more private sector concept, versus sustainable, perhaps a more public sector concept. Be that as it may, it is material that is dealt with. I submit that should one allow that agreement to be formed with the two parties, as always happens when they come to negotiations at the negotiation table, that the public sector comes with its requirements, its needs, its demands, as is spelled out in the bill. It sits with benefit sharing. It sits with its obligations with regard to the rest of the country, etc. It sits with its requirements as spelled out in sections 10, 11, 14, for example. But let that institution then come to the negotiation table with obligation and if necessary report and receive the necessary approval from NIPMO to enter into such an agreement. But once that agreement is entered into, there is clarity. Because without that clarity, it is very difficult to maintain a relationship and to build that public-private relationship and to develop and commercialize that intellectual property, because in the absence of certainty and clarity, it is at risk. My submission goes up to here. If I might pass over to Ms. Baradis, we will deal with specific issues, specific aspects, and specific examples to give a bit more clarity to what is sometimes a bit theoretical. Thank you.
Thank you, Jefferson. I would like to focus my part of the submission on the whole concept of commercialization, revenue, those sort of two definitions that I will address. And what I would like to bring to this meaningful attention is the use of a battle of its intellectual property, which is sometimes more strategic. So please allow me sometimes to use examples of what we regard as strategic use of IP, which is now for quite a couple of years in the practice within SASL on how to use its IP. Now, firstly, in commercializing any process, in putting up any gas liquid or coal liquid plant anywhere in the world, if one compares SASL to the big petrochemical companies all over the world, SASL is a fairly small company. And therefore, we don't have the deep pockets that some of our petrochemical competitors, like the ExxonMobil, the Shell, all the international players have. And therefore, we have adopted this approach of, with the money that SASL has available to spend on intellectual property, to maybe use that intellectual property more strategically. So the main purpose of obtaining a portfolio on intellectual property within SASL, because we cannot compare with a very big portfolio of some of our international competitors, is to define key intellectual property which will protect our competitive advantage. So those are the actual things which we will commercialize, on which we will build a plant, for instance. And then we need to be cleverer because we don't have that much money, and also block our competitors where they can maybe have an alternative process that can get them to the same result. The best example that I can use here is to go from Johannesburg to Cape Town, you can take very different routes. The one route is the direct route, which is most often the most cost-effective process that one will apply. And that is usually the one which you will protect as one of your key IP assets, because that is the one that you would like to commercialize. But if you are competing with international companies that can, for a little bit more money, get to Cape Town in another way, that is, for instance, a process that we will use as defensive IP. So we will claim IP rights on such a process, but we merely intend to commercialize in the strict sense of building a plant on that particular concept for SASL. So we will obtain IP rights, for example, for alternative processes in which you can achieve the same result. We will obtain IP rights to mislead our competitors on exactly what we are doing. And therefore, the bulk of IP rights within SASL is to force some of our competitors to the negotiation table rather of really commercializing that IT industry against Aquaverse. So I hope that gives a clear explanation of how we defensively use IT and strategically use IT. Now, if you want to look at the definition of commercialization, that is paragraph 3.1.1 on page 4 of our definition. Currently, how the definition is phrased, we believe that it actually do include that strategic value or component or the defensive use of IT rights. And therefore, it's quite important for us that there is that understanding that commercialization will also include defensive use of IP, and to remove any doubt in this regard, it's proposed that the words including defensive use are inserted in that definition, just to make it absolutely sure that from a private industry perspective that that is a use which is quite often happening, and we would like to make absolutely clear that that is part of how we read the definition at this point in time. And why it's so important from a private perspective is if one looks at section 14 which of the bill which relates to acquisition of IP rights by the state, one of the requirements there to prevent that section of actually kicking in is to say that it must be commercialized. And therefore it's quite important for us that if a private company is using IP rights defensively, that that will be understood to be a commercialization of the IP and hence prevent Section 14 to get in. I also want to spend some time on the definition of revenue, and this is merely because of unclarity reasons still in the bill. Now that goes to page 6 of our submission, paragraph 3.1.7. Currently, how the definition of revenue is phrased, it is including non-monetary benefits. And because of the uncertainty on how to value non-monetary benefits, it is just proposed here that one maybe excludes that, that non-monetary benefit from the definition of revenue. Alternatively, if one can provide clarity, perhaps by means of the regulation on how non-monetary benefits should be valued, that will solve that unclarity for us. And to illustrate that where that could be problematic, I would refer you to specific sections in the bill. The first one is one goes to page 7 of our submission, and that's section 10 of the bill, which speaks to rights of intellectual property behaviors, the whole issue of benefit sharing. I just want to highlight maybe one example there of the defensive use, and I'm going to pick here one intellectual property right, which is a patent. One usually just assumes that after expiry of a patent, that there can be no more benefits arising from such a patent. Now, if one look at the broad definition and non-monetary benefits, so defensive use of a patent after expiry is that you can use that as prior art to prevent a competitor from obtaining patent protection and this hindering you to do whatever you want to do. So if they obtain a patent, if a third party obtains a patent on a process that you want to implement, you are excluded from doing that. So we see the strategic use of a patent after expiry in that it creates prior art, and hence you will not meet the novelty requirement to obtain patent protection. And if one then look at the broad definition of the revenue at this point in time, which includes a non-monetary benefit, we believe that there is a non-monetary benefit, whatever the value of that is unclear, that there is a non-monetary benefit. And if one links that now to the payment of benefits to the creators of the IP, that according to us puts an infinite term on when
benefit sharing should take place, because that prior art is living forever. And as long as there are eyes to the creator, one will have to pay that non-monetary benefit part to touch her creator or his eyes. Okay, so that is just one example to illustrate how such a small thing in the definition, if that is not clarified, can cause practical implementation of this particular bill. I then want to move on to paragraph 9 on page 7, running over to page 8 of our submission, which actually deals with conditions for intellectual property transactions. And I want to look onto Mr. Duval's submission that we believe that the commercial agreement, as far as it's required in section 15.2d, section 15.2d, should allow for quite flexibility, of course, given that all the text in terms of the bill has been made today. To illustrate by with another specific example, we don't believe that the IP proprietor should be restricted from exploiting IP outside South Africa for true commercial use or for defensive use, as long as there is no restriction on the South African equivalent of that IP right. And that comes to another unclarity which could probably be easily solved in this law with introducing the right wording is. We are not sure if there exists a South African patent, and as you know, if you have your South African patent, I'm going to use patents because that's usually the easy example. If you have a South African patent, for instance, and you have equivalents in the United States, in China, in wherever you are interested, to what extent does this bill apply to the foreign jurisdictions in which you obtained IP? Is it only applicable to the South African equivalent of that, or is it applicable to the whole package, the whole family relating to, for instance, that patent? And we would like to really submit there as long as there is no restriction on what you can do on the South African equivalent. So that is meeting all the criteria set out as the bill. Good flexibility should be provided from a private industry perspective to do in foreign jurisdictions rather what they want to do. A specific example that I can highlight there is, say for instance, it's a co-owned patent between a university and a SASL, for instance, and SASL say that I am interested to also extend protection here to countries A, B, and C, and the university say that we have no interest in extending that protection to those countries, and we are not willing to pay that additional cost. We would like the freedom in the bill and explicitly clearly stated in the bill that such a private funding entity would have the freedom then, of course, on own cost to also secure the IP rights in these jurisdictions where the recipient has, the co-owner has explicitly said that they're not interested in obtaining patent rights. Linking onto that specific example is then also, staying on page 8 of our submission, paragraph 10, which is dealing with section 12 of the bill, and that's the restriction on offshore intellectual property transactions. And again, there I want to highlight this with a very specific example. If, say, for instance, in South Africa, we are not restricting in any way how you can use your IP rights in South Africa, but again, say, for instance, for the USA equivalent of that South African patent, the private funding company is trying to use that extensively. So we are maybe dealing on a USA equivalent, a patent non-assert that a competitor may use that only restricted to the United States, so it's a restrictive right that you give to them, without impacting in any way on South Africa, that the that Section 12 in such a scenario should should not be applicable. And the reasoning behind that is because you haven't restricted in any way. If you actually made all the tips that this bill is required in terms of offshore intellectual property transactions, because you're not restricting where the South African part of that can go, you're only using the USA equivalent of that, put some restrictions on that, and I think there should be quite some freedom on what you want to do if you don't restrict in any way what's happening in South Africa. So the others are just, in short, a couple of examples on maybe more from a private industry perspective, strategic use perspective, some of the unclarities that we have identified in the bill. Again, as we've already said, we are fully supportive of this whole bill, the intention that it has, but we firmly believe that some clarification in terms of actual wording in the bill, alternatively, more specific guidance in the regulations are required to make sure that we can practically implement this bill and don't harm that very good relationship that we have between institutions, universities, and private funding companies. And I want to close now by linking on to what Mr. Joe Allen has expressed yesterday. From a private industry perspective, we believe that it is extremely important to nourish this very good relationship between institutions and private industry. I don't believe that universities on their own can commercialize and get to the point of product, and you will need industry to do that. Industry is more as willing to take that part of the relationship up, but we do need clarity on exactly how to structure that. Thank you, and I'm now handing over to my colleague, Mr. Uday Koshat.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Just to show the other mic. Thanks.
Thank you, Monet. My name is Hugh Lane, and I'm a legal advisor at SAPI, at SAPI Southern Africa. I'm going to deal with the concept of full cost funding. If you have a look at page 10 of our submission, it appears there in paragraph 11.2.6. And I think right at the outset, we believe that we should get away from the concept of cost. What we think is aimed at here is actually an exemption fee, because if you pay the so-called full cost, you are then exempt from the provisions of the Act. And so we think that the language should move towards a concept of exemption fee. But this exemption fee would, of course, be equivalent to the direct costs, which the institution pre-estimates, plus the percentage of its indirect costs. Plus a percentage of those direct costs as a contribution towards this indirect cost. And that percentage necessarily must be flexible. The institutions have got different accounting policies, we understand, and furthermore, within their different faculties, different percentages would apply. So here we see is a real task for NIPMO to get around the institution and to work out in collaboration with those institutions what those percentages should be. So I was just saying, in summary again, we believe that this exemption fee would first of all be the institution's pre-estimate of its direct cost to be incurred in the research project, plus the percentage of those direct costs as a contribution towards its indirect cost. And that percentage would be a percentage approved by NIPMO. And NIPMO would review that from time to time. Now, it's terribly important that this percentage be reviewed and be flexible. We've heard today already about the pressures of international competition. What we don't want is the institutions pricing themselves out of the research market. And let's face it, although institutions like to think of themselves as sitting in an ivory tower in academics, it is a commercial game, and they are in a competitive game. The other concept, which is terribly important to us in private industry, is the concept of certainty. We don't think that the word economic cost, full economic cost, should appear anywhere, because that would open the resulting IP, which may be held by the private industry organisation, to attack. In other words, somebody may say this is not full economic cost, and therefore you don't own your IP, and you've spent millions in the research project already, and you stand to benefit by billions, perhaps, I'm using extreme examples, and somewhat engraves as an argument that you haven't paid full economic cost, therefore you don't own that IP. That would make private organisations very, very nervous indeed. You cannot spend the huge amounts that they do on research, stand to benefit in terms of even greater amounts from IP, and have any uncertainty about whether they're going to own that IP or not. Also, we believe GOP, the well-known GOP, may be inappropriate. It's presently in the draft bill. We think IFRS may have something to do with it. But again, I think by law, the universities have to reflect IFRS or GOP, whatever is prescribed by legislation, but it's their basic accounting policies and procedures that would apply. So in essence, it must be flexible to avoid the dangers of uncertainty about ownership of IP for the institutions. It must be flexible so NIPMO can preserve the competitiveness of universities in this country. We think also that over the page on page 11, we've actually proposed a revised section 15.4b for the state law advisors to consider. We think also that the definition of exemption fee be placed in the exemption. Again, sensitivity to international competition may require that the department cause regulations to be amended, and that is perhaps more quickly done than passing an amendment to an Act of Parliament. I'm going to then just use the opportunity to address specifics, Mr. Chairman. You expressed concern about people making submissions dealing in principles rather than submissions. We have taken the time to give you those, and I'm just going to run you through those. If you go to page 4, the definition of intellectual property. Why I was asking our colleague from UP about copyright this morning was we don't believe that that should be addressed. The issue of students or the publication of students' theses is a very, very sensitive one for private industry. And I'm sure most of us here have a good working of how intellectual property, certainly as far as patents work. There are basically two prime requirements there. One is novelty, and that's in a worldwide sense, but that there must not have been publication worldwide of your innovation. And if there has been publication, then one of those fundamental requirements for the granting of a patent falls through. And that's perhaps the most important requirement for a patent. Now, if a student's thesis is allowed to be placed in the university library before you've had the opportunity of filing your patent, you may not get your patent. And again, that introduces uncertainty. This whole topic is very, very keenly negotiated in negotiations between the institutions and organisations like ourselves. We don't believe that a one-size-fits-all exemption here would apply. We believe that that should be left up to it should be left to be dealt with in the same way that it currently is dealt with, and that is by negotiation between the parties. Also, copyright, the reference to copyright here is wrong. Copyright doesn't protect the facts and the content of what's in the copyrighted work. It only protects the choice of words that's used in a book, for instance, the punctuation, the order of words, or in a painting, it's the colours and that sort of thing. It doesn't go to the content. What we are desperately keen not to have happen is the publication in student species too early of content, that's data and results of research work. So we think that that exemption is wrong. It's also wrong because it goes far too far. It goes not just about copywriting theses with no sort of time reference at all, but it goes to other academic works as well, and we are concerned about what sort of how intellectual property rights could be registered. We're very happy to work with whoever it is to clean that up. And that's copyright. On page 5, we deal with the definition of intellectual property creator. The words involved, as presently in the bill, people involved in the conception are too broad, as that could notionally include administrative staff. And we propose a new definition there, the last paragraph in 313. And it's got to, they have got to entirely or partially created the intellectual property. They can't just be involved in the creation of intellectual property. Then 314, we deal with the concept of intellectual property transaction. And we're assured by DST that this bill relates only, and the sole purpose is to deal with intellectual property arising from public funded research. And throughout our submission, we've suggested that words be added in to make that clear. We know in section 3.1, I think it is, that it says this act applies to publicly funded intellectual property. But we also need the word only there to make it quite clear that this bill only applies to publicly funded intellectual property. 316 on page 5, paragraph 316, just a small point there, the word incorporate would appear to be wrong, and it should be unincorporate, as appears in the Interpretation Act. dealing with revenue, just to add to what my colleague has said about revenue, that the concept of non-monetary benefits is difficult. I understand that that private organisations do make non-monetary benefits available to institutions. An example might be a wing or a laboratory given in a broad sense to a university in return for research. And that would mean that the university would perhaps not have adequate cash in hand to pay the intellectual property creators. But I'm going to come back to them later on. Page 6, paragraph 4, there's a bit of, it's just wording. In some cases, this bill talks about intellectual property arising from, and it talks about intellectual property developed from or emanated from, and we suggested that just one word be used. We suggested the word arising, but there's no find in poetry from our side, and if that's not the right word, let's go for the correct word, but let's use one word. Paragraph 5 on that same page, dealing with section 3, in section 3.1, again, we need the word only to make it quite clear that this bill deals only with publicly funded IP arising from publicly funded research. Then we need, I think, again, to create that confidence and certainty, we need to deal with the issue of possible retrospectivity of this act. And that's in our last paragraph on page 5. We're assured by DST that there is no intent to have this act apply retrospectively. We've also been quite reasonably and nationally cautioned by them that one shouldn't be silly about that and to immediately enter into 10-year research agreements at this point in time. But we proposed a new section 3.3 which would make it clear that, that this act would not apply to research and development taking place, which has taken place prior to the coming into force of the act. On page 7, under item Cultural Research Council submission of develop rather than provide guidelines. And that's something that we would like to work with DST and NIFMO on. And I'd like to endorse their submission this morning. Right, paragraph 8 on page 7 is we make the submission that it's not necessary to include heirs at all in the section dealing with rights of intellectual property creators. Intellectual property is a species of property, and heirs are the concept of heirs and devolution of property to heirs is well provided in our law. There's no need for it, in our view, to be specifically dealt with here. It could create confusion. The concept of minimum of 20%, my understanding is that that's not necessary. That 20%, I think, is perhaps very small. It's very small, and therefore, why have it at all? So there's a good reason alone for not having it. The other reason, and I think a good reason why you don't want it in at all, is because the benefits to creators, to the academics at the university, should be left to the it's the schemes which the institutions have in place to encourage innovation. Now, the institutions compete and should compete. We have a competition law in this country, and I think it's a very good law. It creates rivalry between competitors, and out of rivalry comes lower prices, it comes innovation. And it attracts people. And I believe that the whole concept of remunerating creators, academics within the university, researchers, should be left to the in-house schemes, and they will compete with the in-house schemes of other institutions. And if an institution is not remunerating and encouraging its staff properly, they will move. That's the whole competitive process. The Competition Commission is very reluctant to fix prices. Look at the Nickel Steel Pact, it was guidelines. And I don't think we should try and fix the price gap. I think it's academic, I think it's too small, it's meaningless. Let's take it out for that reason. But the greater reason is that it should be left to the competitive process. If it is going to remain in, then the point that was made earlier about net revenue has to be right. There are big costs that are paid out in filing patents around the world. And I think it's only fair that the university should be able to pay out those big disbursements first and then remunerate their staff. And again, if they're not doing it properly, those staff are going to move. Page 8, item 9, for all the reasons given today, SACI wholly endorses the concept of this act expressly permitting exclusive licenses. I think the point has been made. Dealing with item 9, and it's not in our submission, but in section 11E, the words throughout the world appear. And this is, section 11E. And this is where each intellectual property transaction must provide the state with a right to march in and use those rights. And it uses the words throughout the world. Now, my understanding that it's a fundamental principle of intellectual property licensing that you can't overreach. In other words, if you've got an intellectual property right which gives you a monopoly to a particular territory, you cannot go and give rights beyond that territory. And I'm concerned that the inclusion of the words throughout the world would be tantamount to overreaching, which is not permitted in intellectual property licensing. And that's something which the state law advisors could pick up on. And paragraph 10 on page 8, we suggested that reference in sections 12.1b and c to NIFMO guidelines
just may continue. I'm worried that you get into all the sessions that were referred to as well.
Almost.
So can you just amend your
point? Almost there. We don't believe in infections 12.1 B and C that there should be any reference to NIPLA's guidelines in the Act, because that would have the effect of giving the force of law to questionable bureaucratic requirements which are not subject to the rigor of properly promulgated regulations by the Minister. NIPLA can have non-binding guidelines, and it must have that, and we'll happily work with that, but they must not have the force of law. Those guidelines, that which does have the force of law, must be properly passed regulations. On page 10, item 11.2.3, in section 15.2 of the law, the word separate appears, with a commercialization agreement must appear as a separate agreement. We believe that may not, it doesn't happen in practice. You may have one agreement, a simple research agreement, which includes everything. And we think that word separate is unnecessary, and it could restrict and create unnecessary numbers of contracts. Down to our paragraph 11.2.5, we believe, again in section 15.2, that the word shall should be substituted for may, and we believe that a new section, subsection 15.2e, should be inserted as one of those requirements, that the institution and the private entity agree that it will be a co-owner. Our concern is the word may, because somebody could argue that somebody else, or NIPMA, for instance, has a discretion, and we believe that providing the requirements as we've set it out here, co-ownership will, it must follow, and there's no question about a discretion there. Page 11, item 12, Professor Mohammed gave us a real-life practical problem about the disclosure of sensitive and confidential information, and we believe that the word shall should be substituted for may in section 16. We're very concerned about the transfer of results and data from research being disclosed, even if it is disclosed to NIPMO or to anybody else, again because of that fundamental requirement of publication. Once information gets out into the public domain, that could put the end to your patent. And we've also suggested there that section 16B should be deleted. We believe it's unnecessary and that the other sections should apply. We cannot emphasize more the need to have watertight barriers to highly sensitive confidential information in this regard moving around. My second last point is paragraph 13, the short title and commencement. DST are presently actively engaged in preparing the regulations, and it has involved stakeholders in that process. We believe it's absolutely fundamental that this Act can't come and should not come into effect until those regulations are passed, because there are key things going to be in those regulations which make the Act work. And so we ask and we stress that the Act does not come into operation until those regulations have been finalised, and that the two come into operation simultaneously. The one cannot work without the other. The lack of confidence, the uncertainty, would be grave for people in our situation. The last point I'd like to pick up on is somebody made the suggestion here today that disputes should be resolved by arbitration. Again, I think that is vital. What you don't want are disputes relating to sensitive results and data emanating from research being heard in open court. That is a form of publication. And again, that goes to to destroying novelty, which is your fundamental requirement for patents. So I think that would be a very good way. Obviously, the parties sensibly, Mr. Chair, would go for arbitration for that reason. But I think it would be good to include it. And then we would certainly work with the department if need be to try and devise wording for that. And thank you for the opportunity to make submissions to you.
Thank you very much for the court presenter who are advocating for the whole commission and funding. I think at this stage we must not allow the food outlets to get involved. We form voting from two of us right now. So I hope that we will be able to qualify for the chief of plenty. So we can make an invitation. I don't know whether you've got some time. We should be back here by 1:15.
Thank you. Two short questions. One is, maybe the department would deal with it at a certain point in time. Where there is co-funding, how to deal with that? I am aware the presenters were also asking in the event of co-funding how to deal with it, but most of the research, half of the research is done in that way. Some is part is funded by the public, and maybe part of it is funded by the private sector. In that instance, maybe the regulations will cover that one. I'm not sure. The second short question is the issue of the at least 20%, which the presenters felt it was not necessary to be there. Institutions can just be discretionary as to how they deal with it. Will that not cause any problems at a certain point in time? Or I misunderstood the statement. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mokko. And therefore, they will give response to some of your next set of questions.
Chair, yeah, also linked to the co-ownership and co-funding issue, coming back to the definition of intellectual property and the inclusion of the clause dealing with the exclusion of copyright pertaining to PC interpretation, which is the issue that I raised yesterday. Could you clarify how that particular definition would impact on the co-funding and co-ownership issues in particular? The research and development work commissioned by private sector companies such as those that the presenters represent would result in funding as an institution that is subsidized by the state to a large extent, and therefore this raises the issue that the institution be subsidized by the state contributes to publicly funded research in part. And because the institution is publicly funded and the private sector comes along and asks that particular institution to conduct research and pay for it, we need to establish how one draws distinction, if any, between different types of research. Those purely funded by the state, those partly funded by the state and the private sector, and if there are any other distinctions that we need to be mindful of, because that would determine to a large extent whether the concerns that may be addressed by the exclusion of copyright PCs, dissertation and others is being covered by law, and if not, whether this would be addressed in regulation.
So we take some, I want you, in no order, I think let the presenters respond to any of the questions. You know, you've raised the question of retrospectivity very worrisomely. I don't know of any law that applies to prospectively. But when you raise it, you know, you make it be very, you're constantly curious to say, what is there to be worried about? Could you address that one as well? Please, go ahead.
Shall we answer the question? Now, if I understand your first question correctly about co-funding and regulations, if I understand you correctly, you're asking whether the co-funding problem can be resolved through the regulations and that the bill can go through as is with regard to co-funding. Is that correct?
Yes. And also...
20%. Everything said I've got. Thanks. Chairman, from a co-funding perspective, it is, in my mind, the most difficult part in the bill, to interpret, and it's the broader scope of research and development projects, in my mind, taking place at these institutions. I would therefore be wary of trying to resolve that ambiguity or problem, if I can call it that, in the regulations, because the problem is created in the bill and it's law. More importantly, the regulations are house management issues. And in principle, the ownership and the manner in which ownership has to be dealt with under co-ownership conditions are spelled out otherwise already in the bill to remove the issue of to what extent the rest of the bill applies to co-ownership and to what extent it should be addressed in the agreement, etc., etc. I would strongly advise that it's cleaned up in the bill. It's not huge. These do not require huge issues. It just needs to spell out the relationship in the so-called commercial agreement under co-owning circumstances and those requirements that are set to the institution, what they should take into consideration, how that needs to be dealt with. And I think it's as simple as that. It looks like my colleague wants to add to that.
So, Chair, if I may, I think one of the elements of that question was why was it necessary to have the regs in place when the bill comes in? The regs deal, as we understand it, with this concept of exemption fee or full cost funding. And unless you know what you're in for, and you know that with certainty that if you pay that number, if you're happy to pay that number, you're going to own the IP, you cannot go ahead with the research. You spend a lot of money, and there must be no doubt if it is strategically necessary for you to own the IP, you must know if you're prepared to pay an amount of money and you pay it, you will get the IP. Other issues are assignment and offshore transactions. There are regulations that will impact on that. Part of your decision about whether to do the research or not may involve issues of assignment to other people and may involve, certainly in our case, the case of the three submitters here today, we may well take the IP, or we may want to take the IP offshore, and unless those regulations are absolutely clear and we know that we can live with them up front, we can't proceed with the research.
Okay.
From a 20% perspective, whether it is a huge amount or percentage that you're giving to researchers or a small amount is debatable. The problem is, as soon as you can take that percentage, you make it uniform across the board. Different universities at different times and different faculties at different times have a more or lesser competitive edge, are stronger or weaker out there. If you regulate the funding split or the benefit split between the researchers and the institutions, you generalize that. And you take the ability away from regulations, from the minister, from NIPMO, etc., to take the other conditions into account. One of those conditions we've already seen earlier today is, for example, the non-monetary benefits. Now, under those circumstances, are you still going to pay 20% of what has been received, etc., etc.? So, I think all three of us are in favor of providing for that apportionment. The actual percentage, I would be wary of putting it in the legislation itself. Obviously, in the regulations, one can deal with it, and you can provide it in such a way that the minister, from time to time, can deal with it, can distinguish between institutions, can distinguish between different departments, etc., because from department to department, and from university to university, or institution to institution, those percentages may differ dramatically.
Sometimes I sense contradiction in what the three of us are here today.
to sometimes, you see, not all the time. But when you start to be assured of that, you can absolutely agree. So, the issue that if you link the 20% to the non-monetary benefit, that's more you must elaborate further. Do you still want us to have that in the law or take it out? Just elaborate on that one as well.
About the non-monetary. I fully support our previous submission that we do not wish to see non-monetary considerations in that definition because of the pure nightmare that it will create in valuing it, putting a price tag on it, and apportioning it. My perception is that the bill is about monetary consideration to researchers, etc. When those non-monetary benefits start counting and how you're going to value that, it's a near impossible task. Often, big companies such as Safal, Sapir, Anglo do not count or do not identify a particular research project. They feel that a university's engineering faculty needs support. For example, the so-called previously disadvantaged universities from an Anglo perspective are specifically identified and allocated with huge amount of funds to bring them up to scratch. Some of those funds are in monetary form, and others are from facility perspective. Now, they are often linked to research programs because the idea is to incentivize and create and initiate research. At what stage are you going to start splitting that money? And are you going to apportion it between researchers? So categorically, we feel it should be outside. It was given as an example of where it fooled around with the 20%. I apologize for the confusion.
No problem. Just the
thank you, sir.
Can I just take one question?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Tell us how much. You're telling me 20%, you say take it out. Is this flexibility to competition?
It's very simple. It doesn't make the amount of money more or less that the institution gets. So what you do with it is your problem. I'm saying to you, from a perception, from a responsible citizen of South Africa's perspective that contribute to public funding, I would think twice before I paint myself into a corner from an institutional, a minister, and utmost perspective by locking myself into a specific percentage. But at the end of the day, from a private sector's personal self-centered perspective, you are getting a portion, the institution is getting a portion. What he does with it and how he allocates it, it's his good right. If he chooses to give 20% to the researcher, so be it.
I think our only understanding this thing, not we're not doing on the same way. I don't think the bill is saying 20% needs to be paid. That's not what the bill is saying. The bill is setting that the minimum limit to say anything up, so to protect those people who might actually be paid less. That's the problem, you know. How do you protect those people from the institutions who can be exploited by the institutions themselves? And you do know that institutions do exploit sometimes. How do you protect them? Sometimes we are saying 20% is a limit, and somebody says 20% is nothing, and therefore 10 is outwards, is nothing, the institutions will say far more than that. You are saying, by all means, pay far more than that if you want to. At least, you need to focus on that. You can't. It's like telling us that listen to the market forces. Let the market regulate this whole thing. That's what you are saying in essence. And you are saying you can't leave it to the market forces because there are vulnerable people out there who you need to incentivize to at least to be able to get to 20%. How do you incentivize them if you have a situation where people are getting less than that? You said, someone said, No, it's just because there's competition, they'll pay more, blah, blah, blah. But then why is it a problem to have this thing as a minimum? So that competition can still take place when it takes place. People can still pay more. I got that a big problem when you say, leave it out. In essence, you're saying, leave it to the market forces. Let the market regulate this whole thing. That's what you're saying. So I said, I have a problem in that respect, personally. I don't know. But then we should not engage too much in it to be able to decide this policy for this matter.
Well said, Chair. Please go ahead. No, we engage with those better so that we understand each other. You see? Please go ahead.
Chair, maybe one should look at who these creators are. by students, that could be undergraduate students, that could be postgraduate students. Both of those categories of people, by convention and certainly historically, are not accustomed to having large sums of money in their pockets. Then you have your permanent, well, you might have your postdoc students, I suppose you would still call them, and then you have your professorial, your senior lecturers. Now, those are the people who the university is probably trying to encourage to stay at the university, and those are the people who the incentive schemes will address the most. So I think if you look at the categories of people and who's actually out there, there's no need to put additional funds in the hands of people who traditionally are not accustomed to having large sums of money. And your more senior and permanent staff who are subject to the benefits of the university.
No, I'm saying that the concept that, you know, people who are not accustomed to earning money, don't give them money. I would give them to the report to the IT. I think it's a fundamental issue that that disengagement.
I could share some of the humor that we have at the University of Pretoria and ourselves engage in heavy debates over research and obviously the amount of money that we pay them. And we are forever telling them that their goal in life is the pursuit of truth and not of money. But that's where we concede is changing. But anyhow, we believe in the
market. That some people that have money and not the pursuit of truth.
Chairman, if I may clarify, this 20% is not coming from the private sector. It is coming from the portion that the institution is receiving already. So it is not a private sector issue to say pay them more or less. It is not the private sector that's paying for it, because the amount that is flowing to the institution is a negotiated amount. Of that amount, the researchers are going to get a portion. It is, in my mind, a huge amount and not a little amount. In other people's minds, it's a little amount and not a huge amount. I was trying to stay away from whether it's a big or small amount and merely say most institutions are already sitting with incentive systems and incentive schemes in terms of which they incentivize researchers to legislate those institutions out of the freedom to design and dictate and create their incentive schemes to what is best for them and their researchers. But I think we are merely suggesting that they refrain from that and nothing else. If I may be so rude in moving on to the last question.
No, please move. Please move.
The last question was the one about copyright.
Yes.
If you read the definition, it says intellectual property means a few things, and then it gets to the discussed point, and it says but excludes copyright in a thesis. Now, there are two things that you must note, first of all. Firstly, this is a definition for intellectual property and not intellectual property rights. Now, without going into a legal discussion, intellectual property is like your car, and intellectual property rights is like your ownership of that car, your right as an owner. First of all, therefore, it should not be copyright, but in fact, the thesis, dissertations, etc., that should be excluded and not the copyright, because the term copyright relates to a definition that should have related to intellectual property rights. So correctly it should read, but excludes, and then you must delete copyright in A, and it should read, but excludes a thesis, dissertation, etc., to read legally correctly, number one. Number two, clearly these things are written by students, academics, authors, etc. It is not the intention of this bill, and is definitely not the intention of the private sector, to claim ownership of that copyright. Frankly, I don't know of any private institution, private entity that wishes to claim and own the copyright in some thesis, dissertation, article, handbook, or other publication. It is of irrelevance to it with respect to that author. I appreciate that it's in the author's interest to retain that copyright. But this is not about copyright and thesis. This is about intellectual property created from R&D done by public finance. And this is dealing with intellectual property, the underlying content of that thesis, dissertation, article, handbook, etc. that is at stake and being discussed here. If one wishes to provide for the control of publication of articles, etc., if you want to deal with theses, etc., then one deals with it explicitly in a provision, and I would strongly propose that. But to implicitly bring it into this definition here is always said it creates ambiguity. There's no other intention with the suggestion of amending that, in that definition.
I read it from your written text here, you scribble something else.
It came from my brain.
Can I put your paper so that you can look at it carefully?
Certainly, sir.
You're putting it so convincing.
I'm paid to
do that. I want to read it and see you then have convinced after it.
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, I had an insightful discussion during the lunch break, and the wording which we are critical of may stem from the fact that some academics would like to publish, and they're under restrictions from universities not to publish or to publish only with their approval. If that is so, and if that is the underlying reason for the inclusion of this wording in the draft bill, then we believe that the rights of academics to publish should really be regulated by contract. Quite simply, you may get an amount of money for your professorial duties, and in addition to that, you may have rights or no rights to publish. That should be a matter of private contract. You should negotiate your package, and that should be regulated by contract only. And I think that would eat terribly into the position of universities, who I think need to control publications that go out under their name or in connection with their name.
No, that's fine. Let's hear from Tasso. You know, that's quiet. That is something that's interesting.
As a time, I would actually agree with the definition made by Saki on that it should be regulated by contract. Coming from a more practical angle, so I'm going to give you the definition. Currently, how we regulate copyright work in a dissertation or a thesis is to come into the contract. So we build into a contract that we negotiate with the university a delay mechanism. So we tell them we will allow you to publish, but please wait 6 months or 12 months until we can secure the patent rights on that again, because if they publish premature, then there is no way for us to obtain patent rights on that. So that's the one mechanism that we usually use in a contractual arrangement, make sure that we allow the university to continue with its publication, but merely ask for that delay in time to happen. The second option that we always build into a contract is sometimes a part of what is in a thesis is premature to actually publish. What I mean by premature to publish, it is still considered as confidential information by the private funding company. If you know that it's going to take you 10 years to commercialize this process and get a product on the market, it may be premature to file your patent application already now. Because by the time that your patent has reached the end of its life, you don't even have fully commercialized that process or that product. So in those instances, we prefer to keep that information confidential for a longer time to make sure that the commercialization of the process or the product is timed with the filing of your patent. So therefore, we also negotiate in that contract the right to move part of the information contained in the thesis. To completely remove that and not make that part of the publication. So, and that is just a supportive example to illustrate why we believe that
one can deal with this in a contractual arrangement, which is not negatively impacting on the university, and also not negatively impact on private industry.
I think we must go to a closure now in this. Sorry, what is your
Mr. Chair, just to add to that, I'm sure most people here appreciate that there's a world of difference between research, which is often just conceptual ideas, and development. And often one talks about R&D, research and development. Development is to convert blue sky ideas, as it were, into commercially viable, saleable items, and it takes a long time. You need time. And by the time you apply for your patent, you will have a fuller patent covering those developments towards developed commercially viable items. It's vital to understand how that works.
Let us appear to say why is this matter so important to the private sector? You see, because you can do your own research, you can employ your own research, look at patents, and have full patents, and things like those, and so on. But those are that are publicly funded, so why are you so but I've checked it with my chair. And he reminded me of someone who cried very passionately in one of the videos that he had done, that DG. And it was very much a man who was actually crying to say how he was exploited by the private sector in terms of, you know, his ideas that are making multi-billion dollars. And he's a very poor man. And this is what I was saying earlier on when you say the poor must be left alone. Nothing very good stuff. Yeah, you say that it's not a sensitivity. Let me also tell you about it.
Fine. you suggested that we could do the research on our own. Let's be honest about that so that everyone understands. There is some research that you have to do on your own, because it is so secret, and then often the university has a different perspective on the results of the research to what you do. They wish to publish, and you really often want to keep secrets and use for competitive advantage. But generally, we would love to do research through the universities. It gives the universities the opportunity for kudos to publish. It gives the students opportunities of research.
And if you want me to leave that to the contractual arrangement between you and the institution, you see? And this outcry as well about exploitation that goes for that. Because you are having the dollar, you go to the laboratory and take whatever you take out of your research and continue the life. So those are the things that we must mitigate against as well. You know, how do we ensure that research can encourage innovation and development, and so on, but also that the exploitation is involved. Our role is also to protect the weak and the vulnerable in the business, and to ensure that the big fish also swim freely in the sea of land that we have. So it's a very delicate balance that we want to have here. Anyway, I just wanted to make that point for you to understand that we put a very difficult task. We can't satisfy any everyone. So if we agree with the good luck, if we disagree, we still have to go and vote. I remember there was a task that we had some years ago when I was still very young in the institution about this patent line held by Passover. A plea coming from the then Moscow before Potemkin about how the economy is being hamstrung from development because you don't want to let go for them to develop certain byproducts to do certain things from just looking before and so on and so on. And I think that was the defensive patent that we had to say you're forcing them to come to the table. Those type of issues. So here we want to also looking to unlock the potential in the economy so that people don't have patents and just sit on them. Do nothing. Those who want to develop further must pay them and raise the bottom line. So, yes, but we hear what you say. The question of the regulations that we spoke about, we can't get to. I mean, we were taking your point about not letting that work at all. If you think that we are going to disagree, let me assure you, 120%. Go there and tell Sasol and Ugo and start with it. And we're not really going to get at least from the chair. We're not going to get to you raised section 11E that you take into account. And the most important question about jurisdiction, where our law is referring to throughout the world, I think that's the method that we want to take that, that we haven't lost just for your comfort. Yeah, the other methods are really, thank you also for the proposal that you have in the usage of words. But if you go further, sometimes we say, let's use this word here, substitute this one for instance, as you go on, you reinsert the same word. So, maybe the context is different. So those are the methods that sometimes, whether you read this and see that it was lawyers and economists who created this thing. So sometimes they agree, sometimes they don't. Your last time. One message. Just to say a good time.
The commercialization of technology is an extremely sensitive environment. And I used the example of a cow and the cow's milk advisedly. I was also a researcher once. If you take the milk but you hurt the cow, you only have that milk to use. If you help the cow and you develop the cow, you will have milk in future. We do not only... Our companies do not only place research at institutions, we also have our own internal research. And we are very sensitive to the relationship with researchers because they are emotive, creative people and we are dependent on them every day. But at the end of the day, you want to utilize the milk and you are happy to pay for it. The companies say we are happy to fund research at institutions. Let's work together to get the best out of that research. Premature publication could hurt it. It could hurt the very asset that the institution wishes to trade with. And all we say, it's a balance of all the interests. And perhaps we see the same story and the same picture. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I would really want to add on to that, and I'm going to stress again that I believe the success of this bill in getting this implemented lies in the relationship that is between private industry and the recipients in terms of this bill. And one needs to carefully look at not hurting or unnecessarily restricting that relationship. And if we can succeed to do that, I believe that we will reap the benefits that. That is the whole aim of this bill, and not only to one of the participants, it will be benefits to the private sector, to the universities, as well as to the general public. Because if we don't commercialize any of these products, I think the general public is going to be on the short end of this whole process. So we cannot allow for any obstruction to get to the final end of this bill.
Mr. Chair, Richard earlier addressing you on full cost funding or on the extension fee to say that in our view that number doesn't have to be a very precise number. We understand the mischief aimed at is to address the misuses of the past where inadequate funding was apparently paid by some private institutions and received by some private organisations and received by some institutions. It's really to make sure that an adequate amount is paid above which the private organisation can only the IP. Finally, you asked me to address you on retrospectivity. We don't have a major concern there other than the concept of certainty, which echoes right through our submissions to you today. It would just be very nice to see that there so that nobody can come to us when we've spent a lot of money and are expecting to own valuable IP to clear that because of a timing issue, there is an argument that we don't own that IP. Certainty is vital to encourage private organisations in this exercise. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
You know, I think like I said, we're going to take the other presenters. We've got two more, and I must thank you very much. And I like the analogy of the cow. I've just got my other old man's farm, and I look at those cows and I wondered if they were happy, the way they were milking them. We're going to take the next presentation, and the chair, Colitolo, is going to take over. We're going to take CSIR. Are they here? Oh. CSIR and Saleri. And thanks in advance for keeping to your time. Chair, love.
Yeah, thank you very much. Who's starting? Yes, I have. Eh? And please, if there's an argument on an issue, for instance, that you also want to raise, if it's something like that, then just not try to repeat. I mean, unless there's a new argument that you want to bring forth. But if you want to bring in the same argument, I think we can save up time. You know? Okay. You are on the floor. Yes, I am.
Good afternoon. I'm
Bruce
Walton. I'm in Central Manager at the CSIR. I think time I'll start talking, the slides should load up shortly. In this instance, we've been watching the evolution of the bill from the framework over time and have been very gratified to see the development and would really like to praise DSP for the consultative process followed. And I think we've had some indication that this is intended to continue to the drafting of regulations and implementation, and we look forward to participating in that. Having said that, we have a couple of remaining concerns in respect of the bill as it stands, and hopefully in your deliberations, bill can be turned into what will be a very good act. Our written submissions gave quite specific detail, and we supplied some drafting suggestions where that was needed. I'm not going to dwell on that in the few minutes I have this afternoon, but I also want to and obviously be available to clarify anything today or at a later stage in the deliberations, if that's required. I think the crux of what you're trying to say, and that's come up in some of the presentations today, in terms of where the bill stands now and the changes we'd like to see, is removal of issues of implementation from the ambit of the legislation, so that we keep the bill to the setting principles and the objectives and the purpose, and that implementation issues are left to regulations and to institutions ourselves. The benefit-sharing provisions, which have been the subject of some discussion, I'm going to try not to repeat what's been said before, but maybe shed a slightly different light on where our concern is coming from. And I think the fact that quite a few of us have found this an area necessary to focus on does indicate that it is a real issue of concern. And then I'd also like to raise some observations about effectivity from our experience at the CSIR in carrying out technology transfer, that hopefully as committee members you can keep in the back of your mind when you are deliberating on this bill, and you're in particular on the likelihood of achieving its objectives successfully. In terms of the issue, as I said, for us, and we pointed out in our written submission, those areas which we believe deal more with implementation than with principle that has perhaps come out of the current draft. And the main one of these being the question of benefit sharing. The question of the 20%, I think for us CSR, we have a benefit sharing policy in place where intellectual property creators are entitled to 30% of net revenue. So the 20% in itself isn't an issue. At the same time, we feel this is something that should be left to the organisations to choose for themselves. And I think the other point to bear in mind is that several institutions do have benefit sharing agreements in place, and I'm not aware that any of these is less than 20% to researchers, and most, it's in the region of 30%. So in a way we're saying this is something where there already is some sort of established practice that exceeds the minimum requirements of the law, and as responsible institutions, we would like to see, we would like to retain institutional autonomy to make these decisions in alignment with other existing policies we have with broader incentive schemes, remuneration practices, and HR and finance policies in general. So, you know, the current practice shows there isn't really a problem with what's happening. We know some organisations don't yet have policies in place, and so in implementing a new policy, certainly having some guidelines of what's done is helpful, but we don't believe that that needs to form part of legislation. And having said that, our first preference is not to be restricted by legislation in that respect, but if a minimum of 20% were retained in the bill, in practice it wouldn't have that much difference for us. The question of whether that's calculated on gross or net is an important one. I think our understanding from the department at this stage is that this was intended to be on gross rather than net. And this does become a very important question for us because it's something that's going to influence our decisions in terms of how much we spend on intellectual property protection, for example. If we know that in terms of any revenue that we recover from the successful commercialization of our technology, that a lot of that will immediately be paid over to inventors and not be available, for example, for ongoing costs for patent prosecution and maintenance, that might limit our options in terms of having funds to reinvest in R&D to further develop technologies, build prototypes and things like that. So it severely restricts institutions' options and could bias the best decisions, you know, could prevent us from making the best decisions in respect of how we go about commercializing and exploiting our technologies. It can also lead to unfairnesses between researchers of different kinds, bearing in mind that, you know, at the same time we are rewarding our researchers for publication, sort of teaching and training, functions that they carry out, and then it's depending on organisations' broader incentive and remuneration schemes could lead to inequities. That's why we're really calling it's important for institutions to be able to have autonomy and broad alignment of their policies, and we're scared that this will put us a little bit out of balance potentially. And so in terms of our recommendations in that regard, we would like to confine the scope of the section to establishing the principle that benefits must be shared with intellectual property creators and that policies must be developed at the institutional level to deal with that. And at the least, if any sort of minimums are retained in the legislation, that this be be limited to net revenues. And just as another suggestion in terms of how these things can work in practice out of the scope of the legislation itself, if LIPMO were perhaps to draw up a model benefit sharing policy, this could be used as a guideline for institutions who don't have their policies yet, as well as for those with existing policies to benchmark against. Now, Professor Mohammed earlier referred to some of the complexities of the activity and also some of the potential conflicts that can arise for institutions trying to balance a lot of different objectives. And it's important that we sort of realize there isn't one simple recipe for success. Now, our experience as an organization, probably scientific institution with the longest track record of tech transfer, and as well as a lot of studying that we've done of our systems in terms of developing our own policies and practices, show that there's not just one way to do things. At the same time, certain practices are built up that come to be recognized as good practice or best practice. And I think that's the beginning of developing our own South African community of practice that we want to build on to suit our own unique environment. And so we do need to make sure that we keep the environment enabling enough to allow that. And sometimes that does mean making mistakes along the way, which I think is not the worst thing as long as we can learn from them. Interestingly enough, I think legislation is not a precondition for establishing a vibrant tech transfer enterprise, as one can see by examining systems around the world. At the same time, certainly can kickstart the activity I think even the process that we followed up to now has been incredibly valuable in raising awareness and getting sectors across the national system of innovation to engage with these important issues. But there's a fine balance to be struck between stimulating technology transfer and over-regulating. And I think we can always close up loopholes after the fact if we find there are things that aren't dealt with, but we don't want to close off avenues inadvertently for successful technology transfer. So I'd like to point out technology transfer is only one modality for strengthening the linkages in the national system of innovation. This has already come up in terms of the fact that there's a much broader relationship between industry and the public research institutions, both science councils and universities. International collaborations are a very important part of building capacity and getting access to technology and capacity building, sharing ideas. These are both north-south and, very importantly, south-south collaborations. So we need to make sure that these are facilitated and not hindered by the legislation. So as a committee, I'd like to call on you in your deliberations to give some thought whether you identify any issues in the legislation that promote or hinder this sort of activity. Something else to bear in mind is the importance that freedom to operate for research institutions be preserved, and that licensing and assignment of intellectual property does not prevent research institutions from continuing to pursue the line of research out of which the intellectual property concerns was developed. Some concern we've heard a little bit from the private sector in that regard, but whether there are sufficient incentives to companies to license publicly financed technologies. And while we fully support the preferences and objectives, we know that carrying out in practice can lead to a lot of administrative procedures that companies often can't afford. And to this end in particular, I'd like to point out the role of SMMEs, because I think this is a constituency that has been very silent in this whole process. Largely, I would expect because for people running small businesses, there's very little time to engage in broader policy issues. And if we look at the institutions consulted in the attachment to the bill, and look at who's made submissions now as well as earlier in the process, I think one finds a big gap where small business is concerned. And you bear in mind that small companies and the development and nurturing startup of companies is one of the main objectives of this legislation, you know, particularly technology-based companies. Something that we've noted earlier on as well is that the bill is generally silent on South Africa's development context, and this has also been brought up by some of our vulnerable members. And something that each round we've had to comment, we've considered quite carefully. But I think we've come to the conclusion that the expansive definition of commercialization, which explicitly includes use of technology to benefit society, certainly does nothing to prevent that. CSIR, we have a specific focus on technology transfer for social good. We've employed new staff to develop, help us develop our strategy and concepts in this regard, and so that's something very close to our heart. There were questions about how the ordinary person in the street can benefit from these interventions. And that is precisely the transfer of technology for social good and for public good. And to that end, we'd like to note there are a lot of tools that have been developed, and that certainly an organization like CSIR, we are using, and I think that NIPMO can promote. These include socially responsible licensing terms, particularly humanitarian use licensing. So when technologies, particularly in the areas of health and food security, are licensed to large companies, typically multinationals, who have the best distribution networks to make sure the technology is broadly disseminated. At the same time, license agreements can include clauses that will include fair pricing for the poor and certain humanitarian use exemptions. The use of open access and open source models as well is something that we don't see being limited by the current phrasing and language of the bill, although we did have some concerns with previous versions. So we do feel those objectives can be achieved. I'd then like to also highlight the importance of monitoring the impact of the legislation to ensure that there aren't unintended adverse consequences. I'm trying to promote all of these objectives. I think we're introducing various procedures that will come into play, and we're aware of the fact that sometimes these can have a different effect than what was intended. And so I'd like to call for good monitoring mechanisms to be put in place. Obviously, it's for the committee to decide what sort of parliamentary oversight is needed in this regard. And finally, just to say that echoing what's been said before, the importance of an enabling approach that will be sufficiently flexible to allow for moving in an agile manner when the circumstances demand that. I think that should be achievable with what has been hearing recently from the department in terms of their use of how the bill and the benefit comes back will ultimately be implemented. So thanks for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, CSIR, for a brief and to the point presentation you have made. All of the members are listening attentively, I hope, and they now have questions of clarity today, and they now have useful everyone today. All of the members, the ball is now in your court. Can we interact with this input? While you're still thinking, one of the members, I see, is off at the end. Michael? Okay, the issue of
revenue comes up, of course, in the definition, and benefit sharing comes up elsewhere in the bill as well. And the distinction is made between gross and net revenues. If one considers that we are talking about publicly funded institutions where costs are incurred by institutions while conducting research and development work as well, as an institution that is publicly funded, the distinction between net and gross would indicate that there's a distinction between who bears the cost. And cost would determine what the net revenue would be. If I remember accounting properly, you take cost away from gross to determine what net is. So you only arrive at net revenues after you've taken the cost. If one includes the cost of using facilities of a publicly funded institution, then you're arriving at net revenue. Is this the intention here in the understanding of the CSIR at this point in time? Of the goal, is apparent in the goal, and from the discussions that I had with the department.
I'd like to clarify there that the R&D costs themselves, in our benefit sharing policy, we define that and said exactly what we mean. And when we're talking net here, we're talking generally, but that generally refers to the costs of technology transfer. So the cost of protecting and maintaining the intellectual property and costs associated with the commercialization and technology transfer. So this, there can be substantial costs involved in marketing the technology, doing public market research to find out who the best licensees and beneficiaries are likely to be. And so those are the kind of costs. And in an institutional policy, they get carefully defined. So that doesn't include R&D costs.
Thank you very much. Honourable Stuner?
Okay, just a bit of probe on the presentation. I think the CSIR is calling unto us to consider what issues are hindering or promoting development within the context of South and North-South relations. Can you share further, because you just made that general statement, can you share with us your further observation in relation to that? Maybe it may enrich our own debates and discussions as we deliberate, you know, at the committee level. Thank
you. I think the point wasn't just on that issue. I'm saying in general, and I think this comes to Section 15 of the bill, which I think was drafted in particular with private sector and generally larger companies in mind. But what it starts to raise some questions about other research collaborations. The law is silent, for example, on collaborations with international partners who aren't private sector partners, because that section seems to be confined to the private sector. So there's some uncertainty at the moment in terms of how collaborations with overseas universities or public institutions may or may not be affected by this bill. You know, our view at the moment is that it's silent on it, but there's questions about shared IP ownership, and it was in that context that I raised the question, and I think our written submission has a bit more detail in it. I think basically we want to make sure that those sorts of collaborations can continue, which might involve inserting some sort of positive provision in the bill to make sure inadvertently these aren't prevented in terms of falling into the scope of offshore transactions if there's intellectual property and things like that.
Yeah, just follow up.
Thanks.
Oh, okay.
Chair, thank you. You referred to unintended negative consequences. As the bill is now before us, do you have anything specific in mind?
or possibly to give us examples of such unintended consequences?
Jimmy, the other question here is what you answer to. Hello, sir.
So I think the first question, which dealt with requested some examples of unintended adverse consequences. So I think this really goes to the heart of the legislation. The objectives really aiming to create new South African technology-based companies on the one hand, ensure that South African companies successfully commercialize more technologies developed in South Africa. And so the preferences, for example, that are given, I think, in Section 11 of the bill are preferences that we certainly support. But in terms of practically being able to implement that, when you're sitting as a technology transfer officer in a public research institution, and for example, so preferences are to small business rather than large business. If we have the opportunity, for example, to do a deal with Sasol or a small company that hasn't yet proved itself, there are various decisions that have to be made in terms of what's going to be for the benefit the country, and to make those sort of decisions in practice, to go through the processes, we could, in the long run, and in making those decisions, one could end up not being able to do the deal at all because one is meeting a lot of different requirements, having to discharge a lot of different obligations in coming down to when it comes down to companies often need quick decisions and quick answers and things, can't get it in one place or move somewhere else. And sometimes have to take decisions quickly, which a highly regulated environment can make difficult. So it's a question of balancing sort of freedom to do business with promoting objectives that we support very much. And so it's balancing decisions all along the way. We will have to look in a couple of years to make sure our patents, is patent activity increasing in institutions? Is license agreements signed by institutions increasing as a result of this legislation? Any sign that that might not be happening? Are research collaborations increasing and strengthening? If we find, you know, the private sector response highlighted some of their concerns, if we find that suddenly companies are sponsoring much less contract research at public research institutions, those will be signs that things might not be moving as intended, and that then corrective action will be required. Then the question regarding some clarity on some of the observations, I think the first one is the question of whether legislation is necessary to achieve these objectives. And I think looking around the world, there, more and more countries are starting to legislate, but a lot of countries, we heard about Canada yesterday, the United Kingdom as well, where this activity is happening without legislation, of this nature. Sometimes the subsections are legislated. And so I think the point is it's not necessary to spell out how everything is done and setting the principles and the foundation for the establishment of organizations like LIPLA and for certain minimum requirements for institutions to take on. It's helpful to spell out exactly how each step is done and to bring the details and the implementation in our environment as that looks particularly as not. Then there were questions about points about SME. My point there is that we haven't heard in the last 2 days from any SMEs on the impact of this legislation, and I think even through the consultations before, not necessarily for lack of opportunity, and not to imply that there's been any exclusion of them, but you know, they haven't come forward themselves. And I think this is a very important constituency to ensure included and not hindered at all by the law, because I think one of the key objectives is for new South African technology-based SMEs. So I think not to take their silence value. I think specific interventions over and above the preference for licensing to SMEs are likely to be required, but that might fall outside the scope of the legislation. In terms of the question about the enabling approach to implementation and avoiding over-regulation, I think that was partly answered in the previous question. You know, it's a question of allowing business to take place within a framework, and in our written submission, we said sometimes a suboptimal technology transfer deal is better than none at all. So it's difficult to say up ahead how to structure the best possible deal. The most important thing is for us to get the technologies out there, because somebody's going to be benefiting when we do. If they don't get out there at all, nobody benefits. And so, you know, we'll need to take that approach. And as far as consultation with stakeholders goes, I think this is a broad cross-section of stakeholders that we're referring to, and I think, you know, acknowledge that this has been a very consultative process up to now, and we foresee that it will continue to be, and very much welcome that.
Thank you very much,
I got a message from the Minister of the Communist Party. He's asking me, now that we know, can I put the work at the school of Russia? As we ask a question, we must also try to help to answer the right question in the process, so that we don't just get opposition to the property clause in the Constitution and all these other things, but also to say how to reduce the $100 million question. So, that was put aside. Don't answer this one. My mind's clear.
Yes. So, I think I have one thing to say about that.
I'll come back to you. You see, of course, the beauty about this is that you come into us and say, let me be very clear about the guidelines that they are giving to us out there in terms of this. And first of all, we don't want, let this provision on those subsection 12, 1, B, or C. Let's get rid of that, because we don't want to attack guidelines that are possible. Maybe we should also try and engage on this matter too. For us to be able to deal with the two opposing views as to how we suggest to deal with it. Don't worry, you can disagree with them, you're protected.
No, but I think the
Lastly, we no, not married to the 20%. You can even make it 30%. The point is that you see, you're very sensitive here. Saying to us, 30% yes can do without, because they actually do better. 30%. And we're not going to be opportunistic and say, okay, let's do the 30%. But there are those who are not doing anything. You see? That we want to tie to this minimum. So I just want to understand your sensitivity there to say, you know, it would be nice not to have it, but we're actually doing better. What about those who are not doing anything? Start with that question.
I just want to put one more question to what you actually step up. If we are looking through the teaching, I mean, on the whole question of the community itself, and there's somewhere where you suggested that we have, I think, the regional technology ourselves. You are saying that that must be the traditional, must be replaced with, what do you say here?
It's right.
But you're not giving us a rationale for that here. If you might want to look at this sympathetically, but we don't have, you know, reasons why you think that. And it would be good if you actually respond to that. Now, on the question of sensitivity, you know, there's an argument that almost everybody is making here that this must not apply to non-monetary benefits, which, I mean, I sympathize with. Rather than saying in a situation where there are non-monetary benefits, I would say creators in this respect must not be given anything. Is that what you are saying? Or do we have any other methods in which we think these people must actually be remunerated? What are you saying? I've not heard anybody suggesting as to how we think if a laboratory is given, for instance, to a university, what does the creator get? You're not telling us anything about this in that respect. Are we saying we're not getting anything? You know? Can you get some ideas in that respect as well? Thank you.
Okay, so starting from the beginning and the question of how this benefits the poor. Now, I think it can happen in different ways. I think the one issue, a lot of the research that's been performed on public funding in South Africa is to solve problems of the poor and to improve quality of life. So by getting those technologies out there, you know, that's the first step. Depending on the nature of the technology and who's equipped to actually take it out there, because we also bear in mind as public research institutions, we're not equipped to do that. We have to rely on partners in the public and private sector to do that. It then becomes who are the beneficiaries of that technology and who can best get it to the end users. And that we have to look at on a case-by-case basis. But part of what this legislation is attempting to do is to create new companies, new products, which leads to new jobs, and also increases the fiscus, which allows for more social spending. And then, as I've said as well, as technology transfer offices, we can employ a lot of licensing mechanisms that ensure that South Africans, that public sector, various governments can get preferential access to technologies where this is warranted. So there are lots of different prongs to that. On the question of guidelines and an apparent disagreement with the other sector, I don't think there is a disagreement. Their response was just about referring to guidelines in the legislation, which makes them, you know, give them the force of law. I think they were not objecting, in fact, they did acknowledge that guidelines serve a useful purpose. But just the word guidelines should not be mentioned in the Act. There's nothing to prevent these guidelines from being drawn up. So I think in that regard, we are in agreement. And the question of the 20%, I think, as I said, it's not the organisations that don't have policies yet I think that's because they don't have those revenues to share up. And this is also has a bearing on the question of whether legislation is intended. I think NIPMA engages with organizations that good practice dictates you need to have a policy. This is how, broadly speaking, the policy should be structured, you know, if it's NGO and framework, that could have the same effect. And so, you know, our first question is about preserving institutional autonomy, and the second one is just about the specifics.
Thank you for your question, Minister. Are you conversed with this
Yes. So the 20% remaining isn't the critical issue, but we don't feel that, I mean, I'm not aware of cases that, you know, institutions trying to prevent their researchers from benefiting at all. It might have happened sometime in the past, but not
in the future. If you can let more about go to institutions that don't have policy, is to go to each and everyone that they have policy, and what would be their postman, what would be the type of carrot or stick that they would use to
That's required by the Act in general. So that's not a new the Act in general is requiring all institutions and the policies go beyond benefit sharing as for management of this activity. So that is required anyway in terms of what the legislation anticipates. That could just be one element of that consultation. I think that they will be working with those institutions.
Would it be discretionary for them to use it or not? Would it be absence of a guideline or from the law? It would be up to them to take it or
Yes, but I think what they're saying is we don't believe that anybody is not going to do that. And that there's very well international practices established in this regard.
Mr. Chairman, my question would be, at the CSIR, you have a number of researchers. Do they sign a contract when they come to the CSIR, that would be their remuneration, and that there would be no additional bonuses or any bonus, but if they get something, come up to something, do they then get something?
Yeah, there are other questions that came before this one, yeah? Thank you.
Okay, so there was a question in our written submission. We had suggested introducing the term joint technology transfer as opposed to regional. I think it's a fairly technical issue to allow for the fact that institutions which might have similar needs might not actually be co-located in the same region. So these offices, it's just a broader term. I think it would incorporate regional within it, but might also allow for some of these activities to be managed by a joint office that might not be located in the same region. And then there was a question about suggestion to exclude non-monetary benefits from the definition of revenue. And I think, in a way, this is somewhat academic. You know, the questions have come up around equipment and new laboratories and funding chairs and things like that. And in practice, it's not typical as part of the license agreement. This usually forms the basis of some other agreements, but it might be. The other thing is, so it just becomes difficult to know exactly, to put a financial value on that, and to say that, the cost of if it were part of that, a license agreement, for example, that means the institution's getting money for the laboratory, you need to find those funds from somewhere else to match some sort of payment to the researcher. If non-monetary benefits are included in a license agreement, these are usually closely related to the research that gave rise to the license technology. And so those researchers who created this are usually the main beneficiaries just by having use of the new laboratory and equipment and things like that. And I think the uncertainty associated with that, plus a potential severe financial strain, depending on the nature of those benefits, and that those funds would have to be matched elsewhere, makes it something that in practice we wouldn't actually be able to comfortably deal with. And then that was a question about what CSR's current policy is. We do have a benefit sharing policy in place. So unemployment staff members agree to be bound by the CSIR's conditions of service, and that incorporates a range of policies, including our intellectual property related policies, which we have as a suite of policies at CSIR. Some institutions bring all those into a single policy. And so we do allow, as I said, you know, there's a 50% share go to the intellectual property creators. 50% will go to the operating units they come from, and 50% will go centrally to support either R&D or commercialization activities, with 10% to go towards things like taking costs. And it's a fairly new policy that was approved by our board in November last year, but and also based largely informed by the IPR framework, which at the time was developed, was the sort of authoritative document.
How does the CSIR then determine that 50% which might go to the beneficiary? Do they hand him up front something? Or as that IP is developed, does he get a percentage as money is made?
It's as the money is generated, so it's 50% of the revenues come in, and that is net of certain predefined costs which are set out in the policy. And are largely the not the R&D costs, but the costs of protecting and commercializing the intellectual property.
Thank you very much, CSIR, for the information you have given us this afternoon. We are now going to step off this input. What's your very much to say? Is the work here is going to be online. I just want to ask him a question about the screen saver there. What was the screen saver? Yeah. If you can just show us the screen saver, please, for a moment. Just check something there. Why is that? Danny and Cookie may go out over there. Well, you tell us. When you all this with chocolate and here area or not, this is a certain food that you check out on this screen saver. That leads into some cult of some sort. You may develop some cult. Where is it? Oh, yeah, thank you.
Enjoy the premium.
That is our last presentation for the day. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be very brief, as I realize that I stand between you and the door at this point in time. I'm Phindile Matangane from the South African National Energy Research Institute. And our submission, Chair, is very brief. Would like to be included into Schedule 1 of this bill. Who is Saneri? Saneri was established in response to concerns from national government regarding the perceived threat to indigenous energy research capacity in the country. We're established with a ministerial director from the Department of Minerals and Energy in 2004 as a wholly owned entity of
the Central Energy Fund. We report to both DME in terms of our research priorities, they have an input, and then the Department of Science and Technology funds us up to date. There are two main objectives of Saneri, that of in-house research. We're supposed to undertake our own research. Secondly, we're supposed to coordinate public interest energy research and development. In this regard, we act as a funding agency for energy R&D, as well as a knowledge repository for energy research in the country. In this ministerial directive, Chair, I think it's important to note that Saneri has the right to own, register, and license intellectual property that arises from its activities. There is the energy bill, which is also being debated today in the Portfolio Committee for Minerals and Energy. This bill seeks to establish a South African National Energy Development Institute, SANEDI, and it has provisions in it to allow for the incorporation of SANEDI into this new entity. SANEDI, therefore, will have a research and development division, which will also undertake its own research activities, and also to cooperate and give grants to institutions of higher learning in the country. The bill, the National Energy Bill, also makes provision for this new entity, which will incorporate Saneri, and it explicitly says so that it will incorporate Saneri as one of its own divisions, and it also allows this division to own and register intellectual property. How are we currently dealing with intellectual property as we are state funded? We separate the way we deal with IP into two broad categories. We've got a human capital development initiative where we want to ensure that we build a critical mass of human capacity for the energy sector. That by bursary support, we also establish chairs of energy research in the different universities, hubs and centers of excellence. And for this program, Chair, it's very important to know that Saneri does not negotiate for the ownership of any of those intellectual properties. We leave it up to the institutions of higher learning to own those intellectual properties. But we do have a percentage of our budget that goes into research, whether it's basic or applied research, which is normally on a competitive basis. Individuals, private companies, and public institutions bid to undertake research activities for us. And for this, we negotiate intellectual property rights. And normally, it's co-shared at the moment. How are we funded? Since 2004-05, we've been funded by the national government through the Department of Science and Technology, as I said. We've seen our name coming out into the market, and we've successfully begun to attract private sector funding, especially from this financial year. Our target is to increase this private sector funding, but most importantly, we're looking at developing a third stream of revenue from commercializing of any intellectual properties that we have. So in short, what I'm trying to say is that we've got a long-term objective of having government funding, private sector funding, and commercial exploitation or money coming from that. We find it very important that even if Saneri or in future Saneri generates a lot of money from this commercialization or has got enough money from private sector funding, the government continues to fund research in the energy sector. We believe that it's important for us to own intellectual property because we are actually strategically positioned in the sector to exploit any R&D output. With funding research, if one looks at the value chain of research basic to applied to the prototype development, to demonstration, to commercialization, and full-blown industry uptake, We go all the way up to demonstration, that's how far we fund research. And we are, as I said, a wholly owned subsidiary of the first group of companies, which whose main focus is to commercialize technologies. And we believe that this link is very, very important, because any technologies where we're going to own intellectual property would be able to bring it to the parent company when we believe that the risk of the technology has been reduced. The Department of Science and Technology is also working very hard to establish a technology innovation agency, and we also aim to work very closely with this entity. I've already said, Chair, in my opening remarks, that under the Schedule 1 of the publicly financed institution, we are not listed. And when it comes to the public funds that we receive, if therefore we cannot register or own any IP, and this will hinder negotiations with other public entities in terms of our funding to them, it will therefore tend to limit or influence us to use the private sector funding that we have to finance institutions of higher learning, in particular whom we work closely with. Can I just apologize on the suggested changes? I think I read the last part one, a draft of the bill. When there was Schedule 1, there were two sections, Section A and Section B, which were the institutions of higher learning. So can I read that to say that our suggested changes are that we just be included in Schedule 1, ignore the part about the Section A. And there's no need to update that definition on the definition of institutions in the bill, because I think currently everything in the current draft it will take care of that. So if we were to list that, we would not be in conflict with that. That's all I have to say, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Haneri. Welcome to the point. This guy, there's one thing that Haneri wants. And one thing also. But they need to be included in this shape, in the Schedule 1, in this bill, as one of the institutions that can register for intellectual property. That's all they want. Every other thing you are saying, you are talking about Haneri. I'm afraid this is what Saleri is and what they are doing. And I think we are feeling that challenge. It's not every one of us who know what it is and who understand what it does. I'm sure we'll be able to give, you know, what you are asking us to do, some consideration. Perhaps favorable, I don't know. But consideration is guilty. You know, I don't remember, do you want to have questions on Saleri? I think it's kind of a way for a pop. Oh, but there's a hand there, yes, there's more.
Maybe Saleri also needs to negotiate with the Department of Science and Technology as well.
She suggests that you are also engaged, but I see here that you also report to them. You know? So.
Yes, sure, we do, and we did send our comments to them prior to this meeting. We sent out this
meeting.
The chairperson, we are policymakers. We were made a serious application of duty to say the two entities of state who account to us as parliament must negotiate among us. I think it's a fight and quite appropriate that Department must give their perspectives, you know, why it's excluded. Based on the balance of evidence between what Saleri is saying and the Department is saying, then we must also be privy to your substantive submission. Because you are just telling us that you want to be included. You don't tell us why you should be included. No. I'm not reflecting on you, but I assume that in your submission to the Department, you are giving, you know, the whole context and rationale and whatever. So that when we come into debate on these issues, we are able to make very, very well-informed and considered choices on these issues. Thank you.
I think in the final analysis, you'll be asked who will decide just whether you are part of Schedule 1 or not. But yes, we are going to allow, in any case, the department is going to be allowed to respond on all the issues
that were raised by all the, you know, stakeholders who came here today. So that from the basis of that, we'll actually apply our minds to all the issues that we need. I think we've come to an end. We don't have any presentation to the end of this meeting. And we want to thank everybody who's been here today for the past 2 days. I think we have put many things aside to be here today because we have got a lot of interest in seeing to it that this deal has become a law in this country. Because all of us are agreed that this is a necessary piece of legislation. It has got to be passed. And we want to tell everybody and say to everybody that we will look objectively at each and every input that was made here today. Objectively, I want to repeat, at each one of them. And in the final analysis, we will be able to know as to what our responses are after thorough deliberation. And the co-chair here says there are some announcements that he wants to make. I will therefore give the mic to him. Co-chair?
No, thanks. As we move here at 3 o'clock, he will be ready outside. So don't rush to the airport without having tea first. Secondly, we're meeting here, the venue will be communicated to members, but we're meeting again next Tuesday at the same venue, I'm told. The same venue, where we're going to start off by looking into all the issues that were raised by stakeholders. And we also had the privilege of having a presentation from the department about the previous engagement with stakeholders. Just to check issues that were taken on board and issues that still have to be engaged and what are the issues. So we'll do some matrix of all the issues that are raised and look into that response. We'll give the department the first 5 to respond next week, and from there we'll start our engagement. At least we have the whole day on Tuesday and half day on Wednesday. So if you're making any arrangement to leave or to go back to the constituency, it should be in the afternoon on Wednesday and not in the evening on Tuesday. If we are not done then, Chair, like we have agreed, we'll have another 2 days, some other 2 days the following week before the plenary starts. Chair, you are gentlemen.
Yeah, but before that, I just want to suggest to the department that I think if you need your response, it makes our lives easier. Mm-hmm. I've seen that in the past experience. But if it is in a tabular form, to say these are the issues raised by Zanel, and here are our responses. Here are the issues raised by whichever other body, you know, in a tabular form. So we are able to, you know, cross-check easily, you know, it will help us a lot. With these few words, I want to once again thank everybody and say bon voyage to those who have been to Victoria and those who have been to the U.S.
Because I missed the opening.
Oh, the presenter.